A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us. Israel now holds 70% of Gaza territory, above the 63% already captured, above the 50% ceasefire line. The population is being compressed into a shrinking western strip along the so-called Yellow Line. Reports from the ground document a troubling increase in rat attacks, skin infections, and other problems tied to basic sanitation. But what mechanisms specifically allow rats and these diseases to break out and spread? We keep hearing about rat attacks and skin infections, but nobody actually explains the chain of causation that turns territorial compression into a biological chain reaction.
That's the exact thing that the headlines skip over every single time. They'll mention squalid conditions and then move on to the political angle, and you're left thinking, okay, but how does a border shifting actually cause a rat infestation? What is the actual pathway?
It's like reporting on a plane crash by describing the crater and skipping the mechanical failure. So let's back up and ask the question. Nobody's asking, what is the actual chain of causation here?
Let me start with the numbers that set the stage, because they're staggering. Gaza is about 365 square kilometers total. At 63% captured, that left roughly 135 square kilometers. At 70%, you're down to about 110. But the usable area is even smaller because you've got rubble, you've got no-go zones, you've got areas without any infrastructure at all. The population density in the remaining habitable space, and I want to be precise here, in some areas like the Al-Mawasi humanitarian zone, it's approaching 30,000 people per square kilometer.
For reference, what's normal?
Manhattan is about 28,000 people per square kilometer, and Manhattan has functioning sewers, water mains, and garbage trucks that show up every day. So you're taking Manhattan-level density and removing basically all of the infrastructure. That's the starting condition. And from there, I want to trace three specific mechanisms. The first is waste infrastructure collapse as a rat population catalyst. The second is water system fragmentation, enabling vector-borne and skin contact disease transmission. And the third is population density acting as a force multiplier on transmission rates. These aren't three separate problems. They form a feedback loop.
The first mechanism is the one that gets the least attention, but might be the most important. What happens when waste collection stops?
Let me get into the biology, because this is where the actual explanation lives. We're talking about Rattus norvegicus, the Norway rat, which despite the name probably originated in northern China, but that's a tangent for another day. The Norway rat's reproductive biology is almost absurdly optimized for rapid population growth. Gestation period is 21 to 23 days. Litter size is 6 to 12 pups. And here's the kicker. Females reach sexual maturity at about 3 months. So you've got a species where a female born in January can be a grandmother by April.
That's a terrifying sentence.
Under normal conditions, the population doesn't explode because it's limited by two things, food availability and nesting sites. Rats are territorial. They won't breed beyond what the local carrying capacity can support. You get a stable population that fluctuates within a range.
What breaks that stability?
You introduce a superabundant food source, which is exactly what happens when waste collection collapses. Pre-October 2023, Gaza's waste collection coverage was around 80% per UN OSHA. By mid-2025, it had dropped to an estimated 15 to 20%. That means 80 to 85% of solid waste, food scraps, organic material, everything is just accumulating.
You're essentially laying out an all-you-can-eat buffet for a species that already reproduces at warp speed.
The math is astonishing. A single breeding pair of Norway rats, under ideal conditions, can produce up to 2,000 descendants in 1 year. That's not a theoretical ceiling. That's been documented in urban ecology studies. When you remove the waste collection constraint, you've created ideal conditions. The WHO documented a 300% increase in reported rodent sightings in Gaza health facilities between the 2023 baseline and 2025.
300% in health facilities specifically. The places that are supposed to be the most sterile.
Which tells you the problem has saturated everywhere. But there's another piece of this that I think is underappreciated, and it's what I'd call refugee camp ecology. It's not just that there's more food, there are also radically more nesting microhabitats. Tent encampments, damaged buildings with wall cavities, rubble piles, fabric structures. These are all ideal rat nesting environments. A rubble pile is basically a rat apartment complex. It's thermally stable, it's difficult for predators to access, and it's often directly adjacent to human food sources.
You've got the food supply, you've got the housing supply, and you've got a reproductive cycle that's measured in weeks. What's the actual rat-to-human contact pathway? Because the prompt mentions rat attacks specifically.
This is the part that people find shocking, but makes perfect sense when you understand rat behavior. Norway rats are not typically aggressive toward humans. They're neophobic, they avoid new things, they're cautious. But when population density exceeds the carrying capacity of the environment, you get something called a behavioral sink. The term comes from John B. E. Calhoun's experiments in the 1960s, he created rat utopias with unlimited food and nesting space, and the populations still collapse because of pathological social behaviors that emerge from overcrowding.
The rats basically lost their minds.
In a sense, yes. Normal social hierarchies break down, territoriality breaks down, and rats that would normally avoid human contact become indifferent to it. When you combine that with humans sleeping in tents at ground level, you get rats entering sleeping areas, chewing on exposed skin, particularly on children and the elderly who are less able to defend themselves. MSF reported patients being bitten while sleeping in tents in the Cannes Yunus area during the 2024 outbreak.
Beyond the bites themselves, rats are vectors for a whole suite of diseases.
Leptospirosis, salmonellosis, rat bite fever, hantavirus in some regions. But even setting aside the specific rat-borne pathogens, the rats are also damaging infrastructure in ways that feed into the second mechanism. Rats gnaw constantly. Their incisors never stop growing, so they have to wear them down. They chew through water pipes, through electrical wiring, through whatever they can find. In an environment where 80% of water wells are already damaged or destroyed, that's per the UNICEF, January 2026 report, rats are actively making the water situation worse.
Which brings us to the second mechanism.
Rats are just the beginning. The second mechanism involves something even more basic, water. And this is where the skin infection piece of the prompt becomes really important. When people hear skin infections, they tend to think poor hygiene, end of story. But the actual pathogens have specific transmission mechanics that are worth understanding.
Let's get specific then. What are we actually talking about when we say skin infections?
Three main culprits, Staphylococcus aureus and Streptococcus pyogenes, which cause impetigo and cellulitis, and Sarcoptes scabiei, the scabies mite. The scabies mite is a parasite, an actual arthropod that burrows into the skin and lays eggs. The itching is an allergic reaction to the mite's feces and eggs. It spreads through direct skin-to-skin contact, or through fomite transmission, shared bedding, shared clothing, shared towels.
Fomite transmission being objects that carry the pathogen.
And here's where the water infrastructure collapse becomes directly relevant. UNICEF's January report documented that 80% of Gaza's water wells have been damaged or destroyed. The remaining water sources are largely brackish groundwater and untreated sources. The SPHERE standard, which is the humanitarian sector's minimum standard for disaster response, sets 15 liters per person per day as the absolute minimum for survival. Below that, you can't maintain basic hygiene.
What's the actual access level right now?
In many areas, it's well below that. Some estimates put it as low as 3 to 5 liters per person per day in the most compressed zones. At 3 liters, you're not washing your hands, you're not washing your clothes, you're not bathing. You're barely drinking enough to stay alive, so the hygiene gap becomes a direct transmission pathway. Microabrasions from sand and debris, and there's plenty of both in a rubble environment, create entry points for staph and strep bacteria. And scabies mites, which would normally be controlled by regular washing and changing of clothes, find an ideal transmission environment.
The water shortage isn't just a discomfort. It's a mechanical failure in the body's first line of defense.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. Your skin is an organ. It's your largest organ, and it's a barrier. When you can't wash, that barrier degrades. The lipid layer breaks down. Small cracks develop. bacteria that would normally be washed away before they can colonize get a foothold. And in a setting where 30,000 people are living per square kilometer, the transmission opportunities are essentially unlimited.
Which leads us to the third mechanism, density as a force multiplier.
Let me frame this in epidemiological terms because the math is really clear. Every infectious disease has something called R0, the basic reproduction number. It's the average number of new infections generated by one infected individual in a fully susceptible population. For scabies under normal conditions, RO is about 1.5 to 2. That means each infected person infects 1.5 to 2 others on average. The disease persists, but it doesn't explode.
In the tent camps,
in conditions with 30,000 people per square kilometer, where families are sharing tents, sharing bedding, sharing everything, the effective R0 can exceed 5. Each infected person infects 5 or more others. That's the difference between a simmer and an explosion. MSF reported a 400% increase in scabies cases in the Al-Mawasi humanitarian zone between January and May of this year. That's not random. That's the density math playing out in real time.
Al-Mawasi is worth zooming in on, because it's the designated humanitarian zone, the safe area.
Which makes it the perfect case study for how these mechanisms interact. Al-Mawasi's population density tripled between January and May. People were told to go there for safety, so they went. But the infrastructure didn't scale. It couldn't, because the territory was shrinking and the resources weren't coming in. So you get this perverse situation where the safest place in Gaza becomes the most efficient disease transmission environment.
The humanitarian zone becomes an epidemiological accelerator.
That's the phrase. And this is not unique to Gaza. We saw similar dynamics in the Yemen cholera outbreak of 2017 to 2018, where displacement camps created density conditions that sent the R0 for cholera well above what you'd see in a dispersed rural population. The mechanism is the same. Density plus infrastructure collapse equals transmission explosion.
Let's connect the three mechanisms because this is where it gets interesting. We've got waste collapse feeding the rat population. We've got rats damaging remaining water infrastructure, indirectly transmitting disease. We've got water shortage forcing the hygiene gap, which opens the door for skin infections. And we've got density amplifying the transmission rate for everything. These aren't parallel problems.
They form a feedback loop. And the loop is self-reinforcing. Let me trace the full cycle. Waste accumulates because collection has collapsed. The waste provides unlimited food for rats, whose population explodes beyond normal carrying capacity. The rats damage remaining water pipes through gnawing, further reducing water access. Reduced water access means hand washing and bathing collapse, which increases skin infection transmission. The infections themselves generate additional waste, bandages, contaminated materials, which further feeds the rat population. And the whole cycle is accelerated by density, because every transmission event happens faster and reaches more people.
There's a fourth feedback element too, which is that the sicker the population gets, the less capacity there is for any kind of community-level sanitation effort. You can't organize a waste cleanup when half your population is dealing with scabies and rat bites.
That's the system's collapse element. And what's striking to me is that each of these mechanisms, individually, has a known intervention. This is not a mystery from a public health perspective. We know exactly what breaks each link in the chain.
What are the specific levers? If you could pull them, what would actually work?
Three intervention points, each with a specific threshold. First, restoring waste collection to 50% coverage. That's the number that ecological models suggest would drop the rat carrying capacity below the outbreak threshold. At 50%, you're removing enough food that the rat population can't sustain the explosive growth. You'd still have rats, they're not going anywhere, but you wouldn't have the behavioral sink conditions that lead to attacks.
The second lever,
providing 20 liters per person per day of clean water. That's above the sphere minimum of 15. At 20 liters, you can actually maintain hygiene. You can wash hands, you can wash clothes, you can bathe periodically. The sphere standards estimate that 20 liters per person per day would reduce skin infection transmission by approximately 60%. That's not eradication, but it's the difference between an outbreak and a manageable baseline. Reducing cap density below 15,000 people per square kilometer. At that density, the effective RO for scabies drops below 2. The transmission chain doesn't break entirely, but it slows enough that it becomes controllable through treatment alone. You can treat your way out of a scabies outbreak at RO below 2. Above 5, treatment alone is a losing battle because reinfection happens faster than you can treat.
We know the levers. 50% waste collection, 20 liters of water per day, 15,000 people per square kilometer. These are engineering and logistics problems with known solutions.
Yet the political constraint makes all three essentially impossible under current conditions. You can't restore waste collection to 50% when the territory is being compressed and supply routes are controlled. You can't provide 20 liters per person per day when 80% of the wells are destroyed and repair equipment can't get in. And you can't reduce density below 15,000 per square kilometer when the territory keeps shrinking. The territorial compression is the meta constraint that prevents any of the specific interventions from working.
The spatial buffer is the missing ingredient. Every public health intervention requires some minimum amount of space. Space for waste processing, space for water infrastructure, space for people to not be on top of each other. When you compress a territory below a certain threshold, you eliminate the spatial buffer, and all the other interventions become non-viable.
This is the thing I wish more coverage addressed. The diseases are not just a consequence of war in some vague sense. They are a consequence of a specific, quantifiable set of mechanisms that operate according to predictable rules. Rat population dynamics are not mysterious. Waterborne disease transmission is not mysterious. Density-dependent transmission is not mysterious. These are well-studied phenomena with well-understood parameters.
There's a misconception that's worth naming directly. The idea that these problems are just inevitable in any war zone. That rats and skin infections are just what happens when things get bad.
That's not true, or at least it's not the whole truth. Compare Gaza to the displacement patterns in Syria or Ukraine. In Syria, millions of people were displaced, but they dispersed, some to Turkey, some to Lebanon, some to Jordan, some to internal camps. The spatial buffer existed because people could spread out. In Ukraine, the mass displacement went primarily westward into Europe, and the population that remained had enough territory to maintain some infrastructure function. The Gaza situation is different because the population is compressed into a shrinking box with sealed borders. There's no spatial release valve.
Egypt's border has been closed since May 2024. The sea is blockaded. The eastern and northern borders are the front lines. There is literally nowhere for the population to disperse to.
Which makes it, from a disease ecology perspective, a closed system. And closed systems behave differently than open ones. In an open system, rat populations can immigrate when local density gets too high. In a closed system, they can't. In an open system, human waste can be transported out. In a closed system, it accumulates. Every mechanism we've discussed is amplified by the closure of the system.
Let me ask a forward-looking question. What happens if the territory shrinks further? The prompt mentions 70% as the announced plan. What if it goes to 80? What does the math do?
This is where it gets genuinely alarming from a modeling perspective. The relationship between territory and disease transmission is not linear. It's non-linear. Below a certain threshold. And the model suggests that threshold is around 20% of original territory for a population this size. The density disease curve becomes exponential. You don't get a 20% increase in transmission for a 20% reduction in territory. You get a doubling, then a tripling, then an order of magnitude jump.
Because the feedback loops start feeding each other faster than any intervention could address.
Because you cross physiological thresholds. Below a certain water access level, you're not just increasing infection risk, you're causing organ damage from dehydration. Below a certain caloric intake, immune function collapses, and diseases that would normally be mild become fatal. These are biological cliffs, not gentle slopes.
There's a broader implication here that I think is worth pulling out. These mechanisms are not Gaza-specific.
No, they're not. And this is the part that I think has lasting significance beyond the immediate situation. What we're seeing in Gaza is essentially a case study in the disease ecology of territorial compression. The same mechanisms would apply to any situation where you have rapid territorial compression combined with infrastructure destruction and a sealed population. A siege of a major city. A climate-driven coastal compression where populations are forced inland against a hard border. A future conflict zone with similar spatial dynamics.
The Gaza model of disease ecology could become a template for understanding other crises.
Right now, the data coming out of Gaza, the WHO reports, the MSF case counts, the UNICEF water assessments. This is some of the most detailed real-time documentation we've ever had of these mechanisms operating at scale. Epidemiologists are going to be studying this for decades, not because it's unique biologically, but because it's a rare instance of these mechanisms being so starkly isolated and measurable.
It's a natural experiment in the worst possible sense of that term.
And I want to be careful here, because talking about this in clinical terms can sound cold, but the clinical lens is actually what's missing from most coverage. The emotional response, this is horrible, these people are suffering, that's important, but it doesn't tell you how the system works. And if you don't understand how the system works, you can't identify the intervention points.
The three levers we identified, 50% waste coverage, 20 liters of water, 15,000 people per square kilometer. Those came from understanding the mechanisms. You don't get those numbers from moral outrage. You get them from rat reproductive biology and R0 calculations and sphere standards.
The tragedy is that all three are achievable from a purely technical standpoint. The equipment exists. The expertise exists. The humanitarian sector knows how to do waste collection and water provision and camp decongestion. These are not unsolved problems. They're unsolvable only within the current political constraints.
We've got three mechanisms that each amplify the others. What does that mean for actually solving the problem? The takeaway is that you can't address any one of them in isolation. If you only provide water but don't restore waste collection, the rats keep damaging the water infrastructure. If you only treat skin infections but don't reduce density, the reinfection rate defeats the treatment. If you only reduce density but don't restore water access, you've just spread the hygiene gap over a larger area.
The simultaneity requirement is what makes this so hard. In a normal public health crisis, you can sequence interventions. First stabilize water, then address waste, then treat disease. But in a closed system with active compression, sequencing doesn't work because each mechanism is actively undermining the others in real time.
It's the difference between fixing a car while it's parked and fixing a car while it's driving itself into a wall.
That's not a bad analogy. And the wall in this case is the territorial compression. Every month, the territory shrinks, the density goes up, the waste accumulates further, the water infrastructure degrades further, and the baseline you're trying to restore gets worse. You're not solving the static problem, you're chasing a deteriorating one.
Which brings us back to the spatial buffer. The one thing that makes all the other interventions possible is space. Space for waste processing facilities. Space for water infrastructure. Space for people to not be living in Manhattan densities without Manhattan infrastructure. And that's the one thing the territorial compression explicitly eliminates.
There's a concept in conservation biology called minimum viable habitat. It's the smallest area that can sustain a population without degradation. The same concept applies here, but for human habitation with dignity. There's a minimum viable territory below which the feedback loops we've described become self-sustaining and irreversible without external intervention at a scale that is currently not happening.
We may be watching that threshold get crossed in real time.
The 70% figure is not just a political headline. It's an ecological parameter. It represents a specific change in the density math, the waste accumulation rate, and the water access per capita. Those are not abstractions. They're inputs into a system that produces specific, predictable outputs. Rat population explosions, scabies outbreaks, staph infections. The headlines report the outputs. We've been trying to explain the mechanism.
The mechanism tells you that the outputs are going to get worse before they get better, because the inputs are still moving in the wrong direction.
The one thing I'd add is that the data we have is almost certainly an undercount. The WHO rodent sighting numbers, the MSF scabies case counts, those are from facilities that are still functioning and reporting. In areas where health facilities have collapsed entirely, there's no data at all. The true numbers are probably significantly higher.
The darkest parts of the map are the ones we can't see.
That's the reporting bias in any collapsing system. The worst affected areas stop producing data, so the data we have comes from the areas that are merely terrible rather than catastrophic. It systematically underestimates the severity.
To wrap this into a coherent picture, we've traced three specific mechanisms. Waste infrastructure, collapse driving rat population explosions through superabundant food and nesting sites. Water system fragmentation creating a hygiene gap that enables skin infection transmission, and population density acting as a force multiplier on RO. These form a self-reinforcing feedback loop. The intervention points are known and specific. 50% waste coverage, 20 liters of water per person per day, density below 15,000 per square kilometer, and the constraint that prevents all three is the territorial compression that eliminates the spatial buffer needed for any of them to work.
That's the picture. And the open question, the thing that keeps me up, is what happens when the remaining 30% of territory shrinks further? The nonlinear threshold, below 20%, the density disease curve goes exponential. We're not there yet, but the trajectory is not encouraging.
The broader implication is that these mechanisms are not unique to this situation. The Gaza model of disease ecology, rapid territorial compression plus infrastructure destruction plus sealed borders, it's a template. It will apply elsewhere. Understanding the specific levers and thresholds now means we can recognize them faster in the next crisis.
That's the systems thinking angle that I think deserves more attention. Not just what's happening, but how it works. The mechanisms are knowable. The interventions are calculable. The constraints are political, not technical.
If you want to understand the actual mechanisms behind the headlines, that's what we do here. Subscribe to My Weird Prompts wherever you get your podcasts. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the Aleutians during the late Victorian period, the Phantom Time Hypothesis produced a fringe claim that the volcanic eruption of Bogoslav Island in 1883 actually occurred 3 centuries earlier because the ash layers contained acoustic resonance patterns that, according to the theory, could only have formed during the Little Ice Age.
I'm not sure acoustic resonance patterns work that way.
They definitely do not work that way. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.